Welcome to another episode of the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Our guest today is Scott Leach. He is the head strength and conditioning coach at the University of Rhode Island. He oversees football as well as a number of other sports in the department. Scott is a former football captain and he earned academic honors at Springfield College. Agility training for sport goes well beyond doing cones and ladders, and ultimate preparation for athletes involves task-based stimuli that reference specific aspects of what athletes will be encountering in sport itself. On the show today, Scott will be getting into his weekly speed and agility program. He'll be talking about how he integrates more rudimentary speed with task-based perception and reaction speed, and how he combines that with work in the weight room, with jump training, and the totality of the program. This was an awesome podcast. It was wonderful listening to Scott's adaptation of physical preparation for his athletes. And I know you all will love this episode. Let's get to 404 here with Scott Leach. Scott, welcome to the show. It's awesome to have you here. I'm excited for our conversation today.
I'm excited. Thanks. I appreciate being on.
Yeah, so I know we got a lot of game speed type ideas to get into. One of the things, though, this maybe isn't related, or well, it's not related to things done out in the field, but I saw you had posted something called the 200 rule when it comes to weight room improvements. And I'm like, where has this idea been my whole life? This is amazing. Tell me a little bit more about that rule and how it works in the gym.
Yeah, so a long time, I'm getting old now, I say a long time ago, but I interned at the University of Albany under Connor Hughes. Connor Hughes is now the head strength coach for football at Army. The 200 rule was this, was, you know, I asked him, I said, how do you get your bench press better? He said, you know, go at least one full year without ever failing a rep on bench press. It's really that simple, right? If you don't fail, you get stronger if you stick to the plan and hit your sets and reps. But it's very hard for football players, and it's very hard for younger football players. And I feel like the younger you go, the even harder it gets to not want to just max out your bench press or to just see how many you can do and go to failure. And so the 200 rule, the way we set it up, you know, for a while we'll do tempos, we'll do things like this to really restrict them. But at some point, you know, you may not have a max on them, but you're going to let them go. You know, hey, 5x5, you get to pick the weights today. And as long as you don't fail. If you fail, you have 200 pushups. So it's the first crack, especially for our freshmen when they come in. There's a lot of emotion that goes into it. One, they've been restricted for so long, like 3x10. Coach won't let me put any extra weight on the bar. He won't let me go past 135. Now we let them go. And, you know, they want to prove themselves. They're like, I know I'm a 315 for 5x5 bencher. And or they want to show the upperclassmen, like, you guys will find out how good I am, because it's always the bench press. It's not the squat. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right. There's no real 200 rule for the squat. People always pick safe weights, and nobody early on fails those. But everyone wants to prove themselves on bench press. So we say, all right, if your spotter touches the bar in any way, shape, or form, whether it was going up or not, you know, that's the other thing too, is it forces our spotters to be, you know, no partner spots. And you know, you got to go to 200 pushups. And at this point, you know, our guys, they will like call me over if they think it's going to happen, or they're ready, and they'll be like, coach. And we'll blow the whistle and the entire crowd will go get to pushing. And then we make them go stand on the logo and go do 200 pushups and then come back and finish their workout. And, you know, the idea is like, you failed. Let's do something that's going to make you stronger and better. But hopefully that time away and that little bit of a punishment is a life lesson. And, you know, it's a little touch of embarrassment, but you know what? That's okay. You need to be embarrassed once in a while, and hopefully you learn from it. You know, have I had repeat offenders? Yes, I've had somebody do 400 pushups
wow.
workout, which is because they do it. And then it's like, the lesson is, okay, I got to come back and pick smarter weights, not I got to come back and do that again. So, you know, and if you have somebody multiple weeks in a row and they just can't learn the lesson, at that point, I say your entire group will have 200 pushups. So now the group accountability kicks in and they don't let that person pick bad weights anymore. They go, no, we know you can't do that for five. We're not going to even let you think about doing that for five. So the peer pressure and the group accountability now prevents you from picking silly weights. So it's kind of silly, but at the same time, there's some lessons involved there in maturity in terms of picking the right weights and picking weights that are going to make you better, not just going to failure every session, which, you know, a lot of high school coaches have reached out and said, this is awesome. This is exactly what I need. Yeah, so that's the 200 rule. Connor Hughes at Army. Yeah, I stole it from him.
Yeah, I love that. I was going to ask how many people actually broke that, because what is funny, At first I would have thought, oh, no one's going to have to do 200 pushups, or everybody's going to be, all right, well, I'm going to pick smart weights, I'm not going to fail, or it's going to be extra motivating to get that last rep. But inevitably, I'm sure, yes, like you said, someone's going to end up having to do it. I'm sure.
It's a bell curve. You have people that are really scared. You have most of the team that understands what you're doing and they pick good weights. You have some kids that ride that edge and they're like, coach, I might do it, but I'm ready to do 200 if I fail. And I'm like, okay, I can live with that. You understand the consequence. And then there's just the extremes, and they're just like, we don't care, I'll do 500 pushups if I fail. Like, okay, all right. So there's most of them get it and understand why we're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super valuable. I wish I would have had that in my pocket. I remember one team that I worked with in particular over the years. It was a team that actually, in terms of their bench press, they were the strongest after like their base, kind of the base phase we had, which was actually like kind of circuits and a lot of ISO holds, a lot of ISO pushups, and then some 1x20 type stuff, which like 1x20 on bench, people, I mean, because of the, I think it's not like a set of three or a set of five, people aren't quite as incentivized to put too much on. And then I found as soon as we went to like fives or something like that, people just didn't get any better because they would just put way too much on. Like the whole team or half the team was just putting way more on, failing weights all the time. And their workload for their sport was picking up right about that same time as well that we went to the fives. But I always, you know, it's interesting, the solutions. I guess the one solution on one end would be like, okay, well, maybe we wouldn't go to fives. Maybe we do something a little bit higher or pick something else. But if I would have had the 200 rule, that would have been an easy fix there for sure.
And the best is like, let's say I do want to go to failure. I do want them to hit maybe, you know, a hard 1 to 3. You know, I'll say, hey, the first four sets, the 200 rule is in the house. Last set, no 200 rule. So it gives them that final freedom to be like, okay, I can push this. I can build up to my last set, and my last set, I can go for broke, and there's no consequence for it. So every once in a while, you take the rule off too, and there's a good response to that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of cheering when the 200 rule comes off.
They're excited. Yeah, they plan the session out better. You know, they're thinking about their warm ups and they're thinking about their session better.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I love that. Okay, so I know a lot of what we'll be talking about today is things on the level of game speed and on-field agility training. What have some defining moments been for you and how your approach to game speed has evolved?
You know, it's funny. I think about, I steal a lot of stuff off social media, but my strength coach, my sophomore year at Springfield College, Greg Carasquillo, he was at Nichols College down south. Nichols State down south. It was him and Joel Reinhart, and I'm sure you know Joel. And they posted one time that their off season, they only chose reactive drills, and they it was almost like a challenge to themselves as a staff. I think this was like 2018 or 2017, 2018, something like that back then. And they challenged themselves and said only reactive stuff. And you know, I liked the idea behind that, because I wasn't doing enough reactive stuff in general. So it was like, okay, I need to challenge myself to be a little bit more reactive in training. And then that turned into, can it be reactive, but can it also start feeling and looking a little bit more like football, instead of some of these generic situations where I need to explain, you know, how this transfers to football. It makes it a little bit easier when it looks like it's a drill they did at practice, right? You say, yeah, I can see how this transfers. So it was a great gradual, let's try to be more reactive, let's try incorporate more football drills into what we're doing. Part of some of the stuff too is we're getting less and less time to develop them, whether we're talking about off season getting shorter, because we're trying to get our stuff done so we can get into spring ball and get spring ball done so that we can get ready for a transfer portal. So our total timeline is shrinking a little bit. And then just the development of these kids now is you're getting people on a one-year deal. You know, you're getting a grad transfer, or you're getting somebody who may only be there for 1 or 2 years, and you kind of need to get them up to speed. And the expectation is we're getting them in there sooner. It's not, you know, at least in college football, it's turning less and less into developing somebody and they don't play until their junior or senior year. You know, if they've been here for 2 years and they haven't played, there's a strong chance now that they might transfer to try and go get more playing time. So the drills you do and the things you do in the offseason, you're trying to find more and more ways to transfer and make a more immediate impact. And don't get me wrong, I think there's a lot of value in developing kind of the raw outputs, right? Acceleration and max velocity and the raw skills. But you also need to continually kind of work on the fine-tuned or the sport-specific or however you want to say it. Those skills need to get worked on just as much. Because if they're not getting better at those things in the off season, it doesn't help your case when they get back into playing sport. You know, I like to think of it as acceleration, strength training, power development. That's all improving the car or the vehicle. And then the game specific stuff is improving the driver. And if all you do is work on the car and then you put the driver back in the car and you put them on the racetrack and say, all right, here's a new car, go work, you know, go do your stuff. There's a learning curve there, but if you can improve the vehicle and improve the driver at the same time, hopefully when you put them back on the racetrack, they're both a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that analogy. Scott, so in terms of, you know, you mentioned being inspired or by the idea of all the work we do on the field, it's all reactive. It's all, like task based or task oriented. What is your ratio of like, now of that? So like let's just say linear acceleration work or a max speed run or something like that, versus, or if it's a conditioning run of any sort, versus stuff that's reactive. Where are you at with that and your how you lay out your work?
So it all depends on time of the year. I would say in the off season it's probably more a 2-to-1 ratio of development to application. So, example, if we have an acceleration day, we might have, something technical, whether it's resisted sprinting or some sort of drill to hammer home, maybe, you know, band resistant starts or whatever it may be, or plyometrics. Maybe it's a horizontal plyo that we feel like pairs well. So there's something there for that. And then there's the actual application or the actual acceleration drill itself, which might be timed accelerations. It might be contrast sprints or something like that. And then there's one application drill, and that's your kind of football, your game speed, whatever it is. But that drill, hopefully the dominant strategy to win that drill is acceleration, right? So it's usually a race and chase type of drill. Either we're racing each other to something or we're chasing each other trying to get a tag. But if you don't accelerate, you probably won't win the drill or you won't have a chance in it. So that's the idea there. On a max V day, the priority is probably on max V, so we won't do a ton of, if we do an application drill, it might be a very low intensity application drill. It might be, we usually will pair it with vertical jumping. So don't be surprised if we do like a jump ball battle or something like that, okay, where they both happen to, you know, collide and go up and try and keep it a little bit more. I don't want to fatigue them going into their max velocity sprint, because we're usually rotating, because we train either half the team at one time or train the whole team at one time. So you got to kind of logistically manage that and try not to gas the kids out that are going to go to the max velocity station next. So being smart there. And then a change of direction day, it's off season. It's usually a technical drill, and then it's an actual drill itself where it's, you know, your 5-10-5s or, you know, some sort of box drill or something like that. And then change of direction application is usually some sort of, it's got to have a lateral feel or flavor to it, but that can be a lot more open and reactive environment. So that's usually a create and close space drill. Also, can you create space and get open? Can you close the space as a defender? And then in the summer, what we just do is we usually we'll have those things still in place, but on our conditioning days, we'll start with three stations. One might be contact prep. One might be a create and close space. And then one might be a race and chase type situation. We'll do those first, kind of to get the juices flowing and get some high intensity sprinting in, and then we can get into if we need to backfill with tempo runs or we need to backfill with position specific tempo work, or we can backfill our conditioning with that from there. But we like to start with as much of that high intensity competitiveness and that as our conditioning base, and then we can backfill with what we need. So off season, it's more, we still do the teaching stuff. We still do a lot of the, you know, your PAL principles and things like that. And then as we get closer and closer to a season, then we're trying to find ways to incorporate even more of those reactive drills, the create and close space, the race and chase, and even more contact prep stuff too.
Yeah. With so in terms of like potentiation, because yeah, the competitive stuff's always like such a great potentiator. I could see like after doing all the things in those three stations, and then if you have to backfill with some tempo that's not like too crazy, you probably at least at first that those tempo, those strides probably feel easy, you know, like I feel good, I feel ready to go. So, but you were mentioning early on, like early on, it's like the drill first, like, or the rudiment first and then apply it. But later you kind of flip flop it, or it just moves from teaching into almost pure competitive. And then if you need to add volume, you could tack something on the end.
Yeah. So it's more your off season, right? We come back in January and February. It's very, let's start with teaching. Let's start with sled marches. Let's start with some of those things. And we'll put a small game in there just to space things out and rotate our stations. But maybe as we go on, we don't need to focus on, you know, resist or sled marches. We can get into something like, okay, this is going to be contrast sprints over here. And on the other side of the field, if you're not doing that, we're coming over here and we're doing this race and chase drill. And the idea is, you know, maybe the race and chase drill can get you ready to race over there with the chain sprints. Or the chain sprints, hey, we worked on acceleration, we worked on getting out, and, you know, a great dominant three first steps, getting as much ground as possible. That strategy is going to help you win this drill right here. If you don't accelerate off the line, you're either going to get caught or you're not going to catch this person. So we are always trying to make sure that, you know, we're talking about acceleration, but then also explain that that is a skill that's going to help you win. So let's try and actively work on that, and let's try and bring, you know, it's not just a game. Let's also like, let's think about it a little bit more and how can we win the game?
Yeah. Yeah. I know one thing I was thinking of as you were talking is I like the idea of skills evolving as you move. It's not just moving to more intensity. It's also moving to more complexity. And I think like that's the thing that even in track and field, even in just a pure linear sprint, I still like the idea of like, yeah, like a level of richness, adding a level of richness to what you're doing as you go forward, and not only having like an intensity button. And that's where, yeah, being able to take it from teaching and basic acceleration or change of direction into full out gameplay, not just, hey, we're going to teach acceleration, then we're going to go into sprints. You know, that's the end goal. It's like, no, it's something that's like a tree. It's like it gets more complex throughout the season as you go along.
And I see that sometimes with the high school coaches that I work with is, you know, they see it might be a 1v1 tag game, right? We both are going to go around a cone and then the defender has to tag the offensive player, and they see the drill on social media and that's all they see. It's like, oh, that looks like a good drill. But in my head, there's more to it than that. It's, you know, what are the entry points for the offensive person and the defensive person? You know, is it a static start or are they shuffling and then starting the drill? Because there are a lot of times when you're on the field and you don't start from a static position. So there's that. What happens when you add obstacles into the situation, right? So now you're using maybe a trash can as a defender or as a pretend offensive lineman, right? And now you're using that to set yourself up. And depending on the angle that you come in at, and depending on who you go against. So we talk about that a lot too, is know the person that you're about to go against. If they're an offensive person and they are a speedster and that's their dominant strategy, know that they're probably not going to use that trash can to set you up. They're probably going to try and beat you with speed. So what strategy you take as a defender and what angles you take should change. Now, if you look across and you see the slot receiver who is super shifty, then 9 times out of 10, he's probably going to get to that trash can, use it to set you up, and then try and make his move from there. So you need to change how you're going to go at him accordingly. And those are conversations that we have while we do this. And I think some coaches don't see that sometimes. They just think, oh, game, play game, have fun. Yeah. Yes, true. But there's more you can do with that. You can coach things up. And, you know, I'm not a football coach. I'm not an expert. I played it. I've been around it for a while. I know some things. I don't know everything, right? But the other part too is like, I can have conversations with these guys and they can tell me things that they do at practice or things that their coaches tell them. Yeah, my coach says I need to short stride better. I need to make sure my shoulders stay square when I do this. And it's like, great, you are connecting the dots yourself. I don't have to connect the dots for you. What happens when we bring two people? So now there's two offensive people, one defensive person. How does that change the situation? 2v2. They're not just different drills. There's a rationale and a reason and a thought process. And there's every action has a reaction. So when you decide to add a second defender to the drill, what is that changing for the two defenders? And how does that make it different for the offensive person? So those are all things I'm always thinking about. And it's, you know, sometimes people are just like, all he does is play games. It's like, yeah, I play a lot of games, but there's a lot of thought behind them too.
Yeah. I think on the outset too, you see some of the drills that you do or the games, and a lot of people might just see a lot of chaos, and it's just branded as a big chaotic game, you know, but within that chaos, the better you get at looking at that and understanding, you know, who's trying to learn what and how the variables and the environment is really being steered to teach a particular skill or set of skills. It's a game, but it's a lot more than that, like you said.
And that's one of the things, like, my kids are always asking, can we play handball? Can we play ultimate frisbee? And we'll do that maybe once a summer. I'll throw them a bone. But I don't love playing those games because I don't get to coach and teach. That's purely a game. Handball, let's go out, let's play handball, let's have fun. I can't talk about, hey, you need to use that pick and roll off that to play handball, because I'm talking to football players about playing handball. That doesn't make sense. But yeah, if I give them a drill that looks like football, then we can talk about things. And so the small-sided stuff has worked out better for me than some of the bigger stuff. Like, yeah, just warm the kids up by playing handball or ultimate frisbee. Like, yeah, don't get me wrong, games are fun. Games are a great way to warm. But I don't get to do a lot during that. I don't think the kids learn as much as when you can put them in a little bit more of an educational short-sided or small-sided drill.
If you're a coach looking for an awesome training portal to distribute and track workouts for athletes online or in person, then you can get a free 30-day trial of Team Builder software by heading to teambuilder.com and using the code JUSTFLY. See what Team Builder can do for you and sign up for that free trial today using the code JUSTFLY. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Plyomat. The Plyomat is not only an incredible vertical jump and reactive strength index testing device, but it also is an incredible training device. The Plyomat not only allows single response jumps, but also the chaining of multiple mats together. So you can use it for bounding, multiple series of hurdle hops. And you can get not only height, but reactive strength for a multi-jump situation. It's an incredible, again, testing and training tool. And you can learn more at plyomat.net. Yeah, each of those things has different, it's almost like a different benefit bucket for the athlete. Like a game, if you're a football player, a game like ultimate frisbee, it's more, its benefit is more just fun. It's you know, whatever basic physical activities you get by, or benefits you get by playing a game, and it's better warm up quite often or most of the time than other things. But it's more like a like the Soviets would say, it's for psychological, you know, relaxation. They play a game versus, hey, no, here's a game that it's specific. It has things you're gonna learn that are exactly what you need for your sport. So I know, Scott, you have, like, I believe you've talked about three different, and I think you've mentioned them already, but three main, like, training days or types of training days for your athletes in terms of on-field speed with different emphases. Could you go through those emphases and talk a little bit about what the purpose of each day is, and then that'll be some grounds for us to chat about what goes into each specific type of training day.
So in a perfect world, let's say I can get three high CNS days in a week. You know, that's always the goal. I constantly go back and forth and be like, should we go back to a 4-day model? Part of me is like, yeah, we should, maybe there's a chance we should go back to a 4-day model. But the other part of me is like, what are they going to do on that off day? Half of them are going to come in, and then the other half are going to do nothing. And then it's a ramp up back into another hard day. So it's, I don't know. I keep it at a 5-day, three hard days on there, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, CNS wise. And, you know, the expectation is you'd be ready to go for those. That being said, you know, I always put acceleration on Monday. I know a lot of people will do max V on Monday coming off the weekend. I've tried it, and it's just, I have seen better results of ramping into the week than starting the week off, assuming that, you know, that's the freshest they're going to be. And it's just, I haven't seen it. You know, I have always used as acceleration as a let's get the weekend out of us. Let's get back into it. So we'll do an acceleration. We'll do usually horizontal plyos on that day. And we'll also, if we're lifting as well, it's usually single leg emphasis on that day. Again, a little bit lower on the demand list for CNS, but still CNS intensive. And usually the guys will come back feeling better than when they walked in and they're like, I needed this, this is good work, but it wasn't crushing, you know. And it sets us up for Wednesday, and our guys know that there's, you know, Wednesday we do a couple things. We run fast, we jump high, we squat heavy, and we get paid, you know. We make it's an attitude and it's a mindset. And you know, we're bringing lasers out on Wednesday, we're bringing jump mats out on Wednesday. You got back squats probably on the menu. And, you know, if you're not a back squat guy, whatever, front squat, whatever it is, we got 10 different variations going on during lift, but something heavy is going down on Wednesday. And so it's usually just that. Let's focus on top speed. Let's focus on, we'll do a ton of like ankle jumps and extensive plyos on that day as well. We'll do isometric work as well, just to kind of prime the system, get ready for a good max V. And then
like max isometric work or long, like what's the isometric work look like?
So we'll do like spring ankle complex and stuff like that those days. So we'll do spring ankle, we'll do some pogos and things like that. Just kind of get the system without taxing them too much. Again, because we're usually like, I'm not going to rip 50 guys through the lasers. It just, you know, it would take us logistically forever. It's easier to do, you know, three groups of 15 and rotate through that way. So we'll do that, and then we'll get in there, we'll get into our lift. And then Friday is usually a change of direction day. And so it's got to have some sort of change of direction feel to it. And that's usually it's our grab bag of like whatever else we got left that week. So it might be hand supported split squats, it might be front squats for maybe a younger developmental guy. So we fit all that in there. And then if we're going to do, like I said, if we're going to do conditioning, that's usually on Tuesday and Thursday. It might be early on, it might be pre-programmed drills, it might be kind of, we'll set cones up, there'll be some kind of programmed cone drills. And as we get into more and more in the summer, we'll progress, we'll take some of that stuff out and try and fill it in with more of the create and close space, race and chase, contact prep, football specific type stuff. And we'll go from there. But those are the big three. And then if we can't fit three high days in, then we just kind of wiggle some things around. I'm okay with doing some change of direction with acceleration on a Monday. I'm okay with, you know, mixing qualities. It's not the end of the world. You know, it's not the end of the world if you have something a little bit lateral on your acceleration day, or it's curved sprints. Like, where does that fit in?
Yeah.
I'm okay with it fitting in anywhere, you know, really, because nothing is ever just a straight line, linear or lateral. So that's kind of the template. And then it figures itself out from there.
Yeah. It's kind of cool too. Like I mentioned with the complexity piece, you know, you have an Excel day, but it could be a lot of different days. It could be like Excel plus curvilinear, Excel plus a little bit of change of direction. And even I'm sure like that little flavor, you know, that little change of flavor could offer something that's helpful to that day versus if it was straight linear every time. And it was only the sets and reps that are the volumes that changed or things like that.
I'm very loose with the script. You know, I have the template in place, and then it's, you know, what am I seeing, or, you know, what more can we do? How can we still hit our volume numbers that we're trying to hit for that week? You know, but put a little bit of a different wrinkle in it. If we've been doing race and chase and we want to switch it and do maybe a race and chase on a curve, who's to say we can't do that, you know?
Yeah. So in terms of the Excel day, and I totally agree, by the way, coming off of like the weekend. Yeah, on some, if you look at it purely, well, what's the most intense day? Excel max V. Well, let's do that on Monday. Well, it's like, well, the body after Sunday is probably a little bit rusty in the sense of being ready to fire that one up. And I always just think about, yeah, Excel is such a good, like Pat Davidson talks about, like it's a spectrum. You have everything from step zero all the way to however far you're going, you know, 15, 20, 30, and you get that whole spectrum. It's like a spectrum of calibration. And so I think that's such a great way to come in with that. But what, so like within the Excel day, you said you have like race and chase. Like what are your, tell me a little bit about some of your favorite setups, favorite formats for Excel work to take regular Excel work into something that's perceptive and reactive, and also applicable to situations in football.
Yeah. So, I mean, without looking at any of my notes or anything, just thinking about top of my head, what are variables that you can change, and, you know, what wrinkles can you put into a drill? So start with just your race and chase, and then it can be, you both are going to go on the go call. So it's auditory, it's on me. Next level might be hand reaction. So now you're visually tracking, and those are kind of like, yeah, it's reaction, but those are very basic, rudimentary. We'll change position. So are we going to go maybe out of a 2-point stance, a push-up sprint, half kneeling? We love half kneeling to get out and change direction there. So can you change the starting position? Maybe one person is forward, one person's backwards, right? So we're trying to give an advantage or a disadvantage to certain guys. That's one way to make the drill a little bit harder. I'm going to give you an extra 3-yard head start, but you're going to start backwards. So you have to flip your hips, turn and go. So now there's a hip flip that we're teaching in there that we can talk about. At that point, it's now let's give the kids a little bit of autonomy in terms of reaction time. So now it depends on who we want to make it harder for. You know, if we say, all right, the front person is the one that gets to move first, we've made the reaction now the responsibility of the back person. So it's harder for the back person to win that rep. And we talk about who it's going to be harder for, because then sometimes they're like, well, this drill's not fair. It's like, okay, trade places. That'll even it out. You know, or we'll now make it, hey, the front person can't leave until the back person moves. So now the front person has to look over their shoulder and track that person and react off of them. So that's another way to do it. And then we'll say, you know, early on, it might just be, hey, you got to sprint an arbitrary distance, get 10 yards, get 20 yards. If you can tag them before they get over the 10, you win the rep. If you get over the 10 without getting tagged, you win the rep. But then we might want to start adding another thing that the front person, the offensive person, has to think about. So, you know, one of my go-tos is we call it the Y chase, where the front person sprints up to a cone, and at that cone, they have to make a cut. They either go left and there's an exit gate for them, or they go right and there's an exit gate for them. So not only are they, you know, accelerating, but then they also have to kind of think about, okay, which way do I want to cut? Which foot am I? They're probably not thinking about it, but which foot am I going to plant off of? Do I have enough time to maybe hit a stutter step and, you know, fake like I'm going right and then come back left? Again, they're thinking about who's the person behind me. And if I have somebody who's a great accelerator, I probably don't have time to do that. I only have time to put my foot in the ground and go. And then it gets even harder when now the front person has to react off the back person. So not only do you have to kind of peek over your shoulder, react, but then you have to sprint. And then now you have to think about what was in front of you. And then, I need to make a decision here, and then cut off that and go. And for the back person now, they have a second thing that they have to think about. They have to think about, as they're chasing this person down, think about, okay, if he cuts left, I'm doing this. If he cuts right, I'm doing this. And the goal is, hopefully over time, it's an, you know, automatic decision that they're thinking. It's a subconscious decision that they're thinking about. It's less brain power that they're going through. And then you just find ways to continue to make it a little bit more challenging, right? Is maybe there's more gates, there's more potential exit points for them. So now instead of 2 exits, there might be 4 exits that they have an opportunity to go out of. You might put obstacles in the way and things like that. So it's always start with the easiest thing that the kids can handle. Run straight when I say run straight. Okay. And then from there, it's okay, let's put this little tiny wrinkle in. Okay. How do we make this one step better than last week? Now let's go off the other person. Now let's go at an angle. Let's give them a second thing that they can think about. You know, another good drill that we'll do is a wide chase. And so there's the offensive players on the outside kind of part of the arc, and the defender is on their hip kind of tracking them on the inside part of the arc. Does that make sense? Follow me. So like I'm trying to do it on my Zoom here. So they both go up to the top of the arc like this. And the offensive person is on the outside. They have an opportunity to either finish the arc, or they have an opportunity to cut back to the starting point. So now they've been kind of running, and it's a game, right? It's like, I'm going to go fast, and then I might cut back, or I might stutter step and then still finish. And so that's a great drill that involves tracking. Our defensive players like that, because especially if you're like a DB, maybe you have a hand on their hip and you're trying to stay with them and track them. But that would be more of a we would use that on a change of direction day. And that's, you know, our race and chase, but it's still a change of direction race and chase. So it's always like, what are the other wrinkles? And not just, are we doing more volume, but are we doing things that are a little bit more complex, a little bit more challenging, a little bit more, more reactions, more thought going into it.
Yeah. I like the, even with my track athletes, I'll warm up a lot of times with, one of the last things we'll do is basic like race and chase stuff, just to like, if we're finishing the warm up and we're going to go high jump or something after, I like finishing with a lot of things that are actually partner based or reactive. Cause I find that stimulation actually tends to help you feel more energetic with the next thing you're doing. And so we'll do the race and chases. I have to do that. Cause sometimes it is a thing where it's kind of funny. The person who's running away always runs away so easily. And I'm like, the person chasing them is never going to catch them. So maybe that'll be it. Maybe I'll have
finding ways to make the back person the one that's going to win, like maybe four out of five times. And then it puts a little bit more fire under the front person. And then you get a better effort out of the whole thing. I hate arbitrary warm. I hate, you know, skips and quad holes but I do it right. I gotta kind of like check that box, and our athletes kind of expect that, like, hey, like we can just get into it. And I'm like, you could, but we're not going to have that discussion. So I like to finish some of these kind of, you know, your textbook warmups. I like finishing with race and chase games, especially, you know, I work with some of the other teams on campus, tennis, lacrosse, volleyball, and, you know, get a partner. We're going to go, you know, you can't leave until the front person high fives you. And once they high five you, the race is on and they turn and run, and just getting the juice and the energy going, especially after kind of a textbook warm up where they're just going through the motions and hitting the stretches. It's like you kind of wake them up a little bit in a different way and say, all right, now let's get into what we're going to do today. And I typically find like we get a better session when we add some, just a quick, it takes a minute. It really does. Doesn't take very long to add, you know, one or two race and chase. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. The athletes love it. It's just richness to the session. And it's for sure. Something I was going to ask you as well, or something I was going to mention, because I wanted to ask you about then some of the Max V setups. But I also like the idea, like you mentioned, kind of with that the arc drill, or where the athlete could like choose, where the person had all these choices. They could choose to double back the other way, or they could choose to, you know, stutter step. I mean, it is a thing that, to me, it seems like that's that creates just more, even more richness. Versus typically, it's like, okay, objective, pass, fail, and that's it. And I think for so many, I mean, that's totally fine in many situations. But well, how can you make it richer? Well, you can give the person more options to kind of play. It turns it into a different kind of play. But I think it's like a unique and a really engaging.
Sometimes our football coaches, they're not they like the pass, fail drills. Did you cross the finish line before? Before the other person crossed the finish line, because it's very easy to declare a winner and a loser. You know, it's harder when you set up a 1v1 drill in the box and a defender tries a new technique and they're like, well, I undercut the barrel because I thought I could get there before he made a move, but he beat me with speed. And it's like, he lost, but at least he's trying something new. And you know what? There's so much more value than doing that than just dogging somebody and saying, hey, let's do an L drill and you won it and you lost it. That's just output, you know, and some of that stuff is genetically limited. I'm never going to beat any of our guys on the team. They're all division one athletes and I'm not. But, you know, some of these more open things, and because it looks like fun, it's hard to be like, well, you're a winner and you lost the rep. It's like, you know what? There's nuance to it. And I'm okay with that. And I know some people aren't okay with that. And that's something that they got to figure out.
Yeah. I think that's such a huge point. It's just the ability to, it takes me back actually way back in this podcast, Scott Prochazka, this might've been 4 years ago, had said something about like in just like up and coming football players, like it's like, you're trying so hard just to make it. You never have license to really be creative or try anything. And so it's like in these drills, it's just drills where you give people license to try different strategies, to work with different strategies, you know, and to have a little bit of choice, where the drill is not just you win, you lose. You know, I just think there's that's really something I think is, yeah, it's a really rich training piece.
An example I always give too is, you know, Rhode Island's a very small state. We're not a football powerhouse state by any means, right? We're not going to go to Florida or Texas or and hang with anybody. But we do have good football players here. We do have good football players in the state. And we have on our team here, we have the Rhode Island High School Player of the Year. We have a couple of them. And they come now to college. And I'm a product of Rhode Island high school football. So I can say it. It's not very good. If you're the best player in the state, you're probably just bigger, faster, and stronger than 9 out of the 10 kids on the field, right? So you're just using your dominant strategy of I'm speed, I'm power, I'm going to bully you. And that's why you were good. And now when you come to this level, you know, we see it with our true freshmen who have been high school players of the year, they get exposed, right? Is now everyone is fast. Everyone is strong. You can't just rely on that anymore. You actually need to understand leverage. You need to understand maybe technique in terms of like, how do you blow up a block, or if someone's going to try and come block you, how do you get their hands off and still make a play? And it's funny to watch, you know, someone who's just got so much raw speed and power and strength, and you put them in a 1v1 in the box drill and they're getting crushed every time against people that rightfully don't deserve to win the round, but they're winning because they understand leverage, they understand angles, they understand setting a defender up with kind of their movement patterns. And the only way that kid gets better at those things is putting them in more and more and more of those situations. You know, I can't continue to feed this kid horsepower and make him bigger, faster, and stronger if he's not working on the perception and the reaction and levers and angles and things like those are all things that are hugely important. And that's the difference right now between him playing and not playing is those things. It's not speed and power. He's got plenty of that. So it's finding ways when they're not playing football, when they're not practicing these skills, how can we continue to give them that? And, you know, that's why I don't have a problem with people going home to see their trainer if their trainer is going to put them through some good drills out there, you know. Some trainers will just do bags and cones and ladders, and it's pre-programmed, and there's still no reactive receptive component to it. So it's, if you have a good trainer back home, I always say go back home and go to your trainer, because your trainer's going to work you out. You know, if Sean Mishka is your trainer, then you're good. You know, but otherwise, it's like, you know, I want to see more of that.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Lost Empire Herbs. You can save 15% off of my favorite products with Lost Empire Herbs by heading to lostempireherbs.com/justfly. Use the code Joel15. Lost Empire Herbs is a go-to of mine for supplementation. And looking at the principles, the patterns in nature is such a profound, a powerful observing, a starting point for me in my training. And I've taken that over into supplementation, or my choice of supplementation, as Lost Empire Herbs has harnessed the power of nature, getting things with such minimal processing and such a rich history in Chinese medicine for helping you to improve your vitality, energy, and even strength through their products, things such as Shilajit, the Phoenix formula, and so much more. Head to lostempireherbs.com/justfly today and check out some of my favorite herbs, and there you can get, again, 15% off your order. Yeah, it's definitely probably pretty rare for a trainer to really embrace a lot of those principles. But I guess it depends too if it's like a one-on-one type situation versus like a group of people or something like that. So I wanted to ask you as well, the acceleration day, obviously, and then you have the Max V and the COD day. So tell me a little bit about the Max V day, and then what type of game applications do you have there?
You know, I the Max V day is the day where I'm like, I'm the least or the most insecure about. And it's, I try and keep it so simple. Like, let's just do some things that get us feeling bouncy and get us feeling good, right? So that's why we're doing some light plyos, and we're doing spring ankle complex. And then, you know, for a while I was doing building up to our 10-yard fly. Our 10-yard fly is kind of the gold standard. We have our 20 mile an hour club, and, you know, we have our leaderboards and all that. And, you know, I used to just, you know, first week was like 10-yard build, 10-yard fly. might do that for 2 weeks and then go 15-yard build, 10-yard fly. And then Tony's calling me soft because Tony Holler's like, just why don't you just rip a 20 build, 10 fly from the jump? And I'm like, Tony, like, why you gotta call me out like that? So you know, we've been doing that. And the only time you won't do a 20 build, 10 fly is if you're coming off of an injury. Or, you know, mentally, you're just like, I was on vacation last week and I came back. I don't know if I'm ready for this. You know, I might say, take the first one as a 10 build, 10 fly. And then they're upset that their teammates are running good times and they're running a slow time. And then they're like, all right, I'm going to rip this next one. It's like, all right, you know, we kind of made it there. So 20 build, 10 fly is our gold standard. And for the most part, we'll do that. Everyone will do that because at some point, the big guys got to get out there. You know, the big guys got to get exposed to the highest speed that they're going to do. I can put them in some of these game drills. Big guys know how to game though, right? The bigger you are, and I used to be 285 pounds, I used to be a big guy. You know how to cheat the system a little bit, and those guys will find every angle that they can and every strategy they can so that they don't have to run full speed. So the game drills for the big boys they're a little bit different because they don't like to do the open space stuff as much. But an example of like a max B-day, if we wanted to put a application drill in there, we wanted to do something that feels like football. Two examples of that. One, we call 1v1 versus the punt returner. So you'll have a guy on the quote-unquote punt team. He's got to run down. It might be a 20-yard build-up or 20, 30 yards. And then we'll set up like a hoop. So he's got to add a little bit of a curve, and he has to make a decision. Am I going to go left or am I going to go right? And when he goes around that hoop, then the punt returner, who's on the other side waiting for this to happen, is then allowed to leave. So he can't leave until that guy has made a decision which way he's going to go, left or right. And then the punt returner now has the autonomy to leave, and he's got to try and get to, you know, 20 yards. He's got to sprint 20 yards without getting tagged. So for us, it's the punt man has a full speed sprint, but then it's also game speed because he's got to come in under control and under balance and then not get torched and then be able to make a play. And then for our punt return guy, it's, can you make a move early and then can you accelerate and get up to a good speed and not get caught from behind? So that's one example. And then another example, and these are things I watch football practice and I'm like, we could do that without pads. We could do that. That'd be a good drill. That'd be good in the space, right? We're always looking at the space. Another one that is super popular. Everyone for some reason loved it on social media. We set it up with one offensive person and then two defenders. So one offensive person, they all start together. And then on the whistle, they split. The offensive person goes around a cone and then they run down the sideline. And it's, when you add it up, it's about 30 yards of sprinting. If they make it to the end zone and score, it's about 30 yards of sprinting. So for them, it's dominant strategy is get around that cone and get up to a speed and don't get caught. There's like not a ton of room for cutbacks. There's not a ton of room for change of direction. The dominant strategy is beat them with speed. So we set the parameter and we make it really hard for them to pick any other drill or any other strategy other than max speed. So that's when you're thinking about the drill. It's like, have I given them too much room? Have I given them too much cutback chance? How do we eliminate that? Then the other two defenders, they have to go out around a cone and then get in. One guy has a better angle than the other. So the front guy has an angle that's trying to force and squeeze the trail, you know, squeeze this guy back into the trail defender. The trail defender actually has to like lose ground and then turn around and catch up to everyone else. So for him, it really is a max speed drill for him because he's got to get on his horse and get back in this drill in order to be a person, to make an opportunity to potentially make the tackle, especially if the front person can kind of get this person back inside. So those are two examples there. And, you know, there are things I watch football practice and I'm like, what is the skill? What is the dominant strategy involved here? And does that fit with what we're trying to do in the offseason? So
I'd be curious what some of the miles per hour or velocities guys are running on those like gamified versions. I'm assuming with no pads. Like,
yeah,
which is a little bit different animal than running with pads, obviously, versus like, and like you said, though, it's a 20 to 10 fly. So they might get a little bit more run up in some of the games. But yeah, I'd be really curious what they might hit in a gamified version versus something where it's like you just run. It's just you and the lasers you know, things like that.
Yeah. And let's be real, you're never going to hit, especially if you're playing, you're never going to hit your laser speeds, right? You're never going to hit your 21, potentially your 21s and 22s. You shouldn't necessarily be hitting those in a game. I think there was something about Travis Kelce plays the game at 15 miles an hour or 14 miles an hour, right? So we don't necessarily always, I think it's important to do the max V stuff to build that raw skill. I think, you know, like Tony says, speed is the tide that raises all boats. But can we give them as many exposures to what their game speed is as possible, you know, in that sweet spot of like 14, 15 miles an hour?
Yeah, I know it was, I think it was Kier and maybe Eric Corum, was talking about if your team had a real high team speed on the game, it's probably because they got their asses kicked and were like chasing the other team down the field for most of the game.
The only time, and I'm proud of it, you know, we had a couple trial units 1 year. We blocked an extra point, and one guy scooped it up. One guy was the VIP. He was the security guard. And then the third guy was just running down there to go celebrate. And all three guys hit 20 miles an hour on that. And it was great. Like, it was a blowout, and we were already winning. And then we blocked this kick towards the end of the game, and we scooped it 100 yards and took it to the house. But just, that's the one time where it's great to see 20 miles an hour. Realistically, you're probably getting torched and you're trying to make up for it. So
that's funny.
Context is always key with miles per hour.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a nice segue into like the COD then, COD type training day, just because a day that keeps you round about your game speeds. So, you know, we've covered the acceleration, the max V. I'm sure there's, I mean, COD is probably the one that has the most application of all, like, all different setups. I'd probably most similar to the things I see you posting like on Twitter all the time. I imagine a lot of that stuff is more of a COD type stimulus. Like, it's just reactive, almost more game-like in nature.
It's kind of the grab bag day too, right? Is I can justify like 90% of the drills and be like, yeah, no, there's COD. It's a COD day. but those drills, it's, if we're going to complex anything, it's probably going to be on those days, right? We love starting with the 1v1 in the box, and you got to create space. You have to try and manipulate your defender, get him going one way, you go the other way. And then, like I said, we talk about angles all the time. You know, instead of just going straight at each other, maybe you have to kind of go, and it's like a pitch, right? So you're throwing or a speed toss, or you're coming in motion and we hand it off and go. So it's, now you're coming at it with some speed. And, you know, is that person going to keep their speed and go for the corner? Or is that person going to set you up and cut back? You know, and if, depending on how the defender plays it, you're watching the defender and then you're making decisions off that. And this is definitely the day where we're going to add multiple defenders or offensive players, because now everybody has more decisions to make, right? So as a, let's say I don't get the, and that's one thing I try to do too, is I don't predetermine who's going to get the ball. So it's like, you have to think about both responsibilities. And if I get the ball, I'm going to do this. If I don't get the ball, I'm going to do this. So let's say you do get the ball. Now I'm looking at, you know, how fast is the defender coming into this drill? What angle is he coming at? But then also I have to look at, and these things happen in a millisecond, I have to look at my blocker. What is my blocker trying to do? Is he trying to give me a lane on this side? Is he taking him square on and allowing me to kind of dictate and try? Is he hoping that I set up the defender and then he can kind of readjust his block? You know, what is going on there? And then from there, what, you know, what is my answer? What is my tool that I'm going to use in my toolbox? And then if I'm the blocker, it's kind of the same thing. How hot is this defender coming in? Can I just overpower him and set up a wall? Should I stay in his way and let the guy behind me kind of set him up a little bit better? Is he being very passive and I can go at him and be aggressive? What are the ideas? And then, it only gets more complicated if you go 2v2, right? Because now it's, okay, what side is the ball on? Where is the ball? What angles does that person have? How can I give him better angles? Or if it's 2v1, two defenders, it's okay. Now the defenders, it's not just me going to make a tackle. I need to go make a tackle, but I also need to make sure that if I can't make this thing happen, am I setting up my partner to work together? Can we vice the situation? Can I... If I'm on the right side, I need to stay on the right side. Because if I go over on the left side, I go on his side. Now the right side's wide open. So things like that are all happening. And I think the thing I love about these drills is that there's so many things to think about, but it happens in a second. And it's so fun to just sit there after and talk about it. And that's the great thing is like, you just, all right, two new guys get in there, and then I'll go and I'll be talking to, you know, somebody that just went and said, hey, you see how he set you up there? Like, next time, if you come in, try this, and you might have better luck at it. Now, I can't guarantee it because he might know that you're, you know, he might have set you up with speed the first time, and he's planning on, if he gets another rep with you, he's going to set you up and then cut back again. So like, there's so many layers to it. That's football, though. Football is nothing but layers of layers of layers of complexity. And the guys that can sift through that are the really good football players.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like, in a way, that the, it almost like the week progresses in complexity. Well, I guess, I mean, acceleration is certainly has its own complexities in max V, but like that COD day being later in the week, it's almost like you have to mentally kind of like ramp up, because I would imagine that's the highest cognitive demand for all the different training applications, all the reactive stuff, all the drills.
I would say from a competitive standpoint, yeah, it's the one you have to kind of, because we are going to compete on that day. So you need to find a way to ramp yourself up for that.
Yeah.
And it's the most football one too. So it feels like there's more value in that.
Yeah. Any favorite drills? I know there's, like you said, there's like all sorts of them, you know, throwing different ones in, taking them out. But is there any favorite movement or drills or setups or constraints you've been working with recently on that change of direction day that you want to share?
It's always, you know, it's the 1v1 in the box is the go-to standard, right? So two guys in the middle, back to back, you know, we blow the whistle. You got to go either to the opposite side and then turn around. Sometimes we like to do it off an angle. So you got to go to a corner, go around the corner and get back in the drill. And then from there, it's, can you score and can you tag the guy before they score? And, you know, early off season, we condense the space. So we limit the strategies involved. And then as the off season goes on, that might be a 7-yard box, a 10-yard box. And then it might turn into a very wide box, right? So it's more like you might have from hash to sideline, which is going to allow for like different strategies of, can I just win with speed? Or, it might be a big box, but then there's obstacles in the way. So now the dominant strategy is probably more set up and change direction and cut base. So it's fun because there's so many different wrinkles, and that's the basis. 1v1 in the box. And then what do we progress? What do we change from there? I would say that's kind of the go-to.
Nice. Yeah. Like that home base almost that can almost like, I think sometimes like there's these anchors, especially with complex things. It's nice to have like almost anchors that your mind can kind of like wrap or build other things off of.
And it's funny. We, you know, I'm always encouraging our guys to do extra work and talk to your sport coach and talk to your position coach about drills you can do. And it's never reactive stuff like that. It's always, okay, I can work on my hands. I can work on my first step. I can work on this shuffle pattern. And, you know, it's like, I need to give them this reactionary, visionary component because they're not doing enough of it. And it's something that like intuitively, you don't think about doing that drill on your own. You know, if our kids are doing extra work in the afternoon and summer, like they're not thinking, hey, let's go 1v1 in the box right now. You know?
It's like, that's the special thing about being in team training though. I know for me, like I probably spent way too much time. My team sport was basketball. Way too much time working on skills and not nearly enough working on all those other nuances of actually playing against people in different, you know, constraints or setups and things like that, that would have really made me a lot better. So I
think part of it can be taxing. That is a thing, right? Is if, you know, you say for a summer, you're a basketball player and you say, all right, I'm only doing 1v1 drills with you. And you set up a bunch of different parameters like, hey, we're going to take 10 possessions each off the low post. And then, you know, we're going to take 10 possessions. We're going to put a chair at the elbow and, you know, that's a screen. And then I'm going to come off the screen. Like, you could do that. I think that would be, one, tremendously beneficial, but two, it'd be, I think, a little more taxing than a self-paced, self-regulated, hey, I'm by myself. I'm going to work on this dribble around this chair into this finish. And I'm going to practice that 10 times to know that I got better at those specific things. So there's pros and cons.
Yeah, for sure. Just closing things out here, I know you've mentioned a little bit about, I think you don't typically do conditioning tests, but you do occasionally. And so I'm just curious about, how does this all fit into, or how does conditioning fit into all this? Because obviously I'm sure that just doing this type of work on its own is very good from a conditioning perspective. But what do you, anything beyond that, do you do or testing or anything like that?
Yeah, so I'm very anti-conditioning test. It depends on the test, right? It's you know, I hate 300s, I hate the 110. You know, I did the 24 110s in college. You know, it's funny, like we used to do tempo runs and I had a standard of like 20, 100, you know, 80, 90 or 100 yard tempo runs depending on position. And we started getting rid of the test because one, it's like it's not football, so it doesn't matter. Two, it annoyed me that, like, pass or fail, the next day they were at practice, you know? So it's like, what was the consequence? There was no consequence for it other than, it made me look bad. Oh, that guy didn't work hard this summer. It's like, really? Like, on this arbitrary test, like, what are we doing? But, you know, if I were to do a conditioning test, and there was a lot of pushback to do one this year, so we said, all right, let's do the tribe test, and I explained it to him, and it very fits with what I believe in, right, is high intensity. You know, you got 12 sprints, 5 seconds on, 25 seconds off. You know, Kier's test is simple, and the big thing for me, too, is it's very objective-based. It's very numbers-based, and I can tell our kids exactly how I can rank every kid on the team. I can rank every position. I'm big on that. We set standards. So we decide this is an elite score on the tribe test for a wide receiver. This is an elite score for a linebacker. You know, this is a good score. This is average. This is bad. You know, you need to move up a category. And if you want to be elite across the board, you need to score this. Last time you scored this, you did 8% better this time. So that's big for me is, you know, especially in this day and age where part of our recruiting pitch is, I can get you better. I can physically develop you into a better athlete. I need to have numbers to back that up. I can't just say, well, you can pass the conditioning test. No, you did 17% better than the last time we did this test. I love that. I love being able to objectively tell you, right or wrong, whether or not you're getting better. Because sometimes when you play football, there's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of politics involved, especially in terms of playing time and things like that. I never want strength conditioning to be a question mark. I want to say, here's your progress. You either got better or you didn't. If you got better and you still don't play, we need to start looking at some other things. Rugby guy, here, you know, trap test, I think is for football is a great test. It's gold standard. So it's a good one.
Yeah, I'm sure that's like compared to doing how many 110s did you say? 24 110s?
I did 24. That was over 12 years ago now. So wow. I'm getting a little dated, but and then we practiced 2 days. So we practiced in the afternoon that day. I was like, I don't know.
That's pretty wild. I was just thinking how much more motivating for a player, you know, if you are going to do conditioning or a test for conditioning to have it be 5 second bursts and like rank recorded, published, like, you know, you're seeing your progress. I imagine the buy-in and the output that you see on that is, I mean, and that's just everything.
I'm big on the mental too. I'm big on the vibe that you're trying to create. So for me, 24 110s, the only thought is survive.
Yes, yes.
And I don't want to be on a football field ever thinking, I hope I just survive. Compared to the 12 5 second sprints, you're going against everyone else in your position group at the same time. You're fighting to be the top dog on the leaderboard. There is a competition factor that overflows that situation. And, you know, we have guys that are laying there exhausted at the end because they've emptied the tank for 12 hard sprints. And it's like, that's what football is. That's what I'm asking you to compete and exert yourself, not just survive, you know? And I think that's the old way of doing it is 3 hour practice, grind it. And we got to push them through it and survive. And then, you know, you wonder why they're not aggressive and dominant on Friday night or Saturday night. You know, does everything you do feel aggressive and dominant and competitive? And the more you have those feelings in those situations, the more it's going to show up on game day.
Yeah, for sure. It just makes you wonder too why coaches have seemed to thrive off of a survive mentality for their athletes for so long. Like I'm like, where did that come from? I don't know. It's such an interesting I don't know. It's just interesting to me because, yeah, 100%. Like you said, like if you want to and mirror like the psychology or the mentality and the mind and the body and what you get are kind of like the same thing too. The, you know, the physiology and how you feel about something and how you adapt to it are very, very similar. I mean, I know like me a little bit different, but for myself, when I played basketball in high school and then went and did track, I was actually a lot better 400 runner that year. It was 400 pretty, it was a pretty tough race. And I didn't really train for the 400. I just did a few longer sprints here and there, nothing crazy. And then the next year I went to college and they were training me kind of like a 400 runner. And it was like survival workouts. And I actually got 3 seconds slower in the 400. And now I don't think everybody would for sure, but I do think, I mean, to me, the problem solving, like the task locking on and things like that, there's just something to that. And I think it's a real powerful piece of where is your player's minds at with that.
It's funny that I think the best football and strength did through those sessions, and they did the three a days and two a days and things like that. The ones that survived those are the ones that are built to then go be a football coach. You know, and go grind it out in the office for 12 hours and 14 hours.
That's true.
And just say, hey, this is part of the gig. This is part of the deal. It's like, yeah, dude, you're a grinder. You're a survivor. This is no wonder you picked a job and a career with long hours and low pay. Cause like, this is your identity. This is you and you love it and you eat that up. And it's funny. Like I'm one of those guys. Like I survived the grind and I love the grind and I'm not afraid to do those things. And there's no wonder why I'm a strength coach. Right, is part of that is like it fits my identity. This job and this career fits exactly who I am.
I was kind of wondering to myself. Another thought in my head was like, yeah, what kind of projection? How is this being projected from the coach to the athlete? So you answered it really well right there. So let's finish up here. I know you have like a pre-contact, so it's not necessarily what we've been talking about, but it is related in terms of football preparation. So I think there's a football or pre-contact educational resource that you've been working on.
Yeah. So I've been doing this for a while and it's funny. I tell the story. We started introducing this contact prep stuff. And a lot of these ideas are from, you know, like Andy Ryland's a great example over at USA Football. He's phenomenal at teaching this stuff. There's a lot of application from the rugby world as well. But back in 2020, we started adding it into our offseason. The idea being you can't go from Thanksgiving, and in college, you go from Thanksgiving-ish to spring break, and then you start your spring practice. You can't go that entire time without being physical. You can't collide, roughhouse, if you want to call it that. You need to have their skills involved in being in close quarters, close proximity. You know, football, there's a lot of that. So how do we introduce those things? How do we get those things going on? How do we talk about impact-induced muscle soreness, so bumps and dings and stuff. Can we introduce some of those things safely now so that the first time they put pads on in March or April, they're not super sore from falling on the ground. They're not super sore from blocking and pushing and straining in those positions. You can lift all the weights in the world sometimes, and I use this example. You can lift all the weights in the world, but there's guys that when you ask them to then push a body, they're not good at pushing a body around. And you're like, dude, you're a 400-pound bencher. How do you not move this kid? So there's some transfer. There's some transfer in these contact prep things. So we started this in 2020 in January. And then everyone said, no more contact. They said, you got to keep 6 feet, right? So the contact prep disappeared. And it was funny. Like we came back from COVID and all that. And that was a big chunk of time that we weren't getting physical. We weren't colliding. We weren't getting in other people's personal space. So it's a skill you need to incorporate. And, you know, I've had a lot of coaches ask, how do we do these things? And another guy who's phenomenal at it is Kurt Hester. He puts a lot of stuff out there with contact prep. And I just wanted to put something together to teach, you know, whether it's a college strength coach, a high school strength coach, or even, you know, it's a football coach or a rugby coach or somebody that is in charge of these things, and they may not be an expert in it. So how do you safely teach an athlete to, whether it's like rolling and crawling and falling, and then progress that into some partner drills, whether it's, you know, partner bear position pushes and pulls, or we like to do shoulder to shoulder and hip to hip isometrics, start with those things. And then can we progress it to something a little bit more competitive later on? You know, we have examples like you hug a med ball, so the clamping and squeezing, and you know, part of a tackle is you have to clamp and squeeze and finish and can't let that person go. You hug a med ball and then the other person's trying to rip that med ball out of your hands and you're trying to maintain good posture and good positions and things like that. And you know, we also will use it as a conditioning component, especially for our big guys, our offensive line, our defensive line. Everybody benefits from it, but those guys in particular, that is the thing that exhausts them. That is the thing that makes them sore, is moving another body, pushing another human around. I don't always think wrestling practice is the answer, but I think there is some, depending on your school and your setup, I think there is some transfer from wrestling back to football. So it's all of that kind of combined in one course that hopefully can teach you how to introduce these things safely and progress them over time, just like we talked about today with a lot of the race and chase and type drills. How do you make it a little bit harder? How do you make it a little bit more competitive? How do you make it a little bit more physically demanding? Start with the easier drills and progress from there. And I talk a lot in the course as well about maturity and teaching, especially high school kids, how to be a good partner, because it is roughhousing and it can get sloppy really quickly. And I think that scares some coaches away. I don't want somebody to get hurt doing contact prep, so we don't go near each other in the offseason. I've had more football players in college get hurt playing pickup basketball in their own time than training with me.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
There is a safe and a smart way to do it. And if I can do that instead of them getting their contact prep from pickup basketball, then I'm good.
I think pickup basketball is the bane of many sport coaches and many colleges and universities for sure.
It crushes me. I have had so many rolled ankles and things like that. And I'm like, why? Why? I get it, though. I like pickup basketball, too. So I get it. But yeah.
That's awesome. So if people want to find that course or learn more about you, is there a place that they can go and learn more?
Yeah. I mean, can we put the link in the show notes or something like that? Is that the easiest way? And then I have it on my social media as well. So if you look up my name and try and find me on Twitter or Instagram, it'll probably be pretty easy to find. So
sounds good. Well, hey, thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate you coming on the show and just sharing your vision and how you've built out game speed and agility work. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode, and I'll see you next week.